Welcome back to the Ministry Growth Show. I'm Zach Layton. Today's conversation is with Todd Hall. Todd is a professor of psychology at Biola University, the author of Relational Spirituality and the Connected Life, and the founder of the Relational Spirituality Academy. His work brings together attachment theory, neuroscience, and Christian formation. And here's why I wanted to have him on the show today. A lot of Christians, including a lot of leaders, carry a belief that doesn't get talked about much. They believe the right things about God. They serve, they study, they pray, they teach, but they feel far from Him regardless. The doctrine is intact. It's the closeness that's a struggle. The standard answer most of us have heard when that comes up is to try harder, read more, pray more, confess more. Todd's work pushes that back on that a little bit. In this episode, we talked about the difference between head knowledge and heart knowledge. We talked about how the relationships that formed us shape what we feel in prayer, often without our awareness. We talked about why vulnerability has to start with leadership before it can spread through a church. And we got into something I'm really passionate about, which is the connection between story, structure, and healing, and what that has to do with how Scripture itself was given to us. I think you're going to get a lot out of this one. Here's my conversation with Todd Hall. Hey, Todd, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Zach. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you on the show. I'm right in the middle of probably halfway exactly in your book, Relational Spirituality. And so your insights have already been a blessing to me. And so I'm excited to have you on and just hear your thoughts and your story. And maybe that's where I'd love to start is just your story. How did you get into this and how has your maybe your story impacted your research or vice versa?
Yeah. So this journey of writing these books and kind of developing this relational spirituality framework really does come from my own story of disconnection. And so so I've told this in various places, but the short version is grew up with a mom who my mom struggled with a lot of mental health issues from pretty early on and then left the family when I was about 9 years old. And so lived with my dad, didn't have a lot of contact with my mom after that, some contact, but that, you know, her leaving plus all the mental health issues just led to a lot of disconnection, within my family, obviously, but also within myself. And later in my relationship with God. So, and, you know, I developed strategies to try to protect myself from that pain. Back then it was, you know, I wasn't very aware of this. We all do this. Mm-hmm. I've learned a lot about this, but they all kind of backfire in the long run and end up leading to, you know, less authentic relationships and more distance. And, you know, as I mentioned, it shaped my relationship with God. I became a Christian about the age of 10. So shortly after my mom left. So fast forward to college, attending a Christian college and taking Bible and theology classes. So learning quite a bit about God, but growing increasingly distant from God, just feeling more and more distant from God by the end of college. So that was very, you know, disconcerting, just not really understanding why that was happening. And oftentimes feeling like this was my fault. I was doing something wrong. I must not know enough about God. I must not be, you know, serving enough, you know, whatever, what my faith isn't strong enough, you know, all those messages, the voices that, you know, go through our head. And that sometimes, unfortunately, we hear in the church, right? So it was only later that I realized that this distance from God was at least partially rooted in these early family relationships, you know, growing up, particularly with my mom. And so then, you know, there was a turning point in college where I kind of hit, you know, at that point, sort of a rock bottom, so to speak, where some relationships were falling apart. And really felt God speaking to me, inviting me into this deeper journey that I've been on for, you know, a long time now of just really looking at kind of my interior life. So the message was kind of like, you know, there's some things inside you that you need to face and you need the help of others and you need me to help you with this. So it wasn't an audible voice, but it was a very, you know, one of those distinct moments that I remember and really felt that God was speaking directly to me and actually was through a speaker at Biola. I was just sort of like walking around campus after some relationships had fallen apart and wandered into the chapel and there was somebody speaking no idea who this person was or what. I can't remember even the topic, but felt God speaking to me through something this the speaker said. So that was just kind of the beginning point, and just led to opening up, seeking out, you know, some help from mentors and therapy eventually, and, you know, and then getting into psychology and realizing, like, oh wow, this really kind of helps me understand myself, the impact my family's had, relationship with God, you know, and all that. And so, you know, the Reader's Digest, fast forward, that led to actually an undergraduate. I was exposed to this whole field of integrating psychology and theology, right? This idea that they're not mutually exclusive, that psychology can actually help us unpack and understand how God designed us. Mm-hmm. And understand the sanctification process. Obviously, there's, you know, secular psychology, there's some ideas out there that are not biblical, but there's a lot of good there if we really believe that, you know, all truth is God's truth. So I was exposed to this idea that led to, you know, graduate school and kind of being drawn to clinical psychology and further studying this at Biola, where I now have the privilege to teach, bringing together psychology and theology. And, you know, eventually that just led to, you know, relational spirituality is really kind of just the further development of that journey in undergrad and then grad school. And my dissertation was on that topic, trying to wrestle with how do these fit together. So there really were two parallel tracks, Zach. There was, you know, like my own journey was one track, just trying to piece together how my family impacted me and what is this distance about and how do I grow to actually feel closer to God. And so that grew through, again, relationships and, you know, with some mentors and therapy. And then there was the conceptual track of trying to understand how does this all fit together from scripture and, and how does psychology help us kind of understand how we actually grow spiritually.
Yeah. That's cool. Well, and one of the things that I've really resonated with is this, you've mentioned it a couple of times, but this idea of how our stories have a pretty profound impact on how and why we relate to God the way that we do. And so that's been my own, maybe a lot of my recent journey is just studying that and looking into that and it, seen the impact that it really has, that I grew up in the church, but I didn't really ever, no one talked about this growing up in the church. You know, it was just, you just needed to know more about the Bible and that would solve all the problems. And yet I still struggled with this idea that God didn't delight in me. I still struggle with that he doesn't delight in me, or how could he delight in me? You know? So yeah, that our stories and the things that the relational experiences that we've had growing up, how they impact now, how we relate to God the way that we do, and how we relate to others the way that we do, how we relate to ourselves the way that we do. Guys like you and Thompson and some other authors have just really put words to something that I couldn't describe or explain. And so it's been cool to just have words for it. I don't know that I've, you know, come to a solution for any of it, but it's been helpful to know, okay, there is at least some theories around this and why this stuff happens.
Yeah. And like you said, having words for your experiences is super helpful, especially when it's not being talked about in the church. And that's part of the story making or narrative process. Is to just, it's part of any growth process. I think it's part of, you know, it's a key part of psychotherapy, but also coaching, discipleship, spiritual direction, you know, whatever modality you want to talk about that helps us grow. It involves telling our story, and putting words and language to our experiences, because that brings together these two ways of knowing that I talk about, which I'm sure we'll get into, and helps us to bring these experiences into relationship with God and with other people.
Well, and that's just so, you know, we haven't had a lot of communication, the two of us, before this conversation. So for where we're coming from, I got into the storytelling space and a passion around storytelling from a marketing and communications perspective. And so the more I dug into it, the more I you know, discovered authors like yourself and others who are talking about story, maybe outside of the confines of the marketing and communication space where I was learning about it, mm-hmm. I started to recognize, oh, this has far more significant implications than just how we're communicating in the digital space. Like it has implications, storytelling has implications for our leadership development or disciple making or spiritual formation or leadership development. I think I said that one already, but storytelling now for me, working within the ministry space, but only coming at it from that marketing and communication side, I started to recognize, oh, this is far more significant than I ever imagined. And so it's been fun to explore that kind of stuff as well. And what storytelling really means and how we're such story beings and communicate and relate to one another through story. And so, you know, as I dove into that and recognized, oh, my story and my experiences, my relational experiences have far more of a profound impact on me than I have ever or would have ever maybe realized. So
yeah,
it's been interesting to come at it from these different perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is fascinating. Yeah. And I think it's another way of saying, you know, we're story beings, as you put it, or, you know, story making creatures is another way to say that we're relational beings also, right? Because we connect to each other through story, not mainly through information, right? And that's becoming, you know, I'm sure you're having these conversations, right? It's becoming more and more clear with AI as information is, you know, not just ubiquitous, but it's being generated now by AI. But AI, you know, as wonderful as it is, doesn't have personal experiences.
Right.
You can connect with in a personal human way.
Right. Yeah. And it's, we use it for a bit of content writing, quite a bit of content writing now to assist in both our stuff and some clients' work. And it's, we're constantly creating new rules or adding to the rules and instructions to make sure it's not fabricating these stories, because it keeps trying to come up, like no matter how many instructions we give it, it still wants to fabricate stories and act like it's experienced something. And then it just comes across as, no, I'm the one writing this. That's not an actual story that I've experienced. So stop inserting those things into our content. So it's an interesting, definitely an interesting dynamic. Yeah. We could have a whole, you know, probably 3 or 4 episodes on AI and the implications for it. But I want to focus on kind of the topic today, and maybe get into a little bit of what you talk about in relational spirituality, book you co-authored with your wife, Liz, and, this idea of pulling together theology and attachment theory and the study of neuroscience, and how all those things, work together, specifically with what you're trying to do within Relational Spirituality Academy and your books. Can you help me understand just the integration of all those things and how you came to these conclusions?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think if we think about it in terms of like the core problem that I was trying to address in relational spirituality and the connected life, so that's the trade version of the book, there's kind of two tracks or dimensions. So one is sort of like the experience of people in the pews and churches, right? Which is what has sometimes been called the sanctification gap by Richard Lovelace. And I think I use that language as well, which is, or some of the language I use, the split between theology and spirituality, or the split between explicit knowledge or head knowledge and implicit knowledge. So the idea that we have so many people in churches who know a fair amount about God, right? So that's explicit knowledge or head knowledge, but really aren't growing in their capacity to love God and others, or, you know, sanctification. And so, I mean, this has been, you know, going on for a while, but, and I think still a concern and an issue. So that's kind of one level of, you know, the experience of what ministry leaders are seeing, you know, in the pews. And then the other dimension is the training model that church leaders, ministry leaders are being trained in, you know, in seminaries and other places. And that is a model that essentially focuses on explicit knowledge or head knowledge or doctrine, and kind of the idea that sanctification and spiritual growth happens primarily through information, through learning about scripture and doctrine and God. Even if that's, mm-hmm. you know, oftentimes it's not like most churches have, you know, some sort of master document that explicitly says that, right?
Right.
But it's the implied or implicit kind of view of this, mm-hmm. this is how it works. And so this is how we're going to do church, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to focus on teaching and explicit knowledge and programs and all those kinds of things. And it's not that those are bad, but what I'm trying right. to argue in the book is that that's been, especially in Western Protestant evangelical context, that has been overemphasized for a number of historical reasons, and at the expense of relational knowledge and mm-hmm. growing in relationship with God and others. And so there needs to be kind of a corrective. So those were kind of the problems I was addressing. And then part of the impetus for the book as well was seeing that there was a convergence happening in all these different fields, some of which you just mentioned, starting probably going back to the 1940s. In a number of fields, there's what's called a relational turn, right? We see this in psychology, and it's particularly in the field of psychoanalysis with attachment theory, but also, you know, psychoanalysis is kind of a separate subfield. We see this mm-hmm. in theology with Trinitarian theology. We see this in philosophy. And so that has just been growing. And then you have neuroscience coming online and, you know, affective neuroscience, looking at how the brain processes emotion and relationships. That's pretty new, but in the last, you know, 5-6 decades, we've seen a convergence of all these different fields pointing to the same basic fundamental conclusion, which is that human beings are fundamentally relational in mm-hmm. the way that we grow and develop and heal. And part of that comes from, you know, I mean, Trinitarian theology, as I mentioned, and I think is very consistent with a broad biblical view of sanctification. So that was part of the impetus as well, was like to pull all of this together into one cohesive kind of model and place and try to address this problem of this split where, you know, we're teaching and focusing on explicit knowledge, but we don't really have a very good understanding how we grow through relationships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that was my experience, and still, again, like I said, it's been a struggle of mine. I know all these things in my head. I know intellectually that God delights in me, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But knowing that implicitly, knowing that in my heart, that there's a disconnect there. And so again, one, to have your words to it, gave words to it. There's another book I read recently called Transformed Into Fire by, I think it's Judith Haugen. She talks about some similar ideas, and so it started to put again words to my experience. For you, what was your experience in your day-to-day life that kind of started making you realize or recognize, hey, there's a problem here within my experience, maybe within I'm seeing this within the church. Mm-hmm. And so what were you personally running into that made you go, I want to dig into this a little bit deeper?
Yeah, I think a lot of the roots of that goes back to grad school and first learning. Well, so my own experience of, you know, distance from God and like, okay, I'm, mm-hmm. you know, going back to undergrad, I'm praying, I'm involved in service, I'm learning about God, and that kind of continuing to grad school. But feeling very distant.
Was there this angst with your experience with church and what you were getting from that experience? Mm-hmm. It wasn't, there didn't seem to be a solution to that disconnect, that implicit and explicit knowledge exactly. disconnect.
And I think what highlighted it was in grad school, then starting to learn about these relational processes and, you know, clinical psychology, mm-hmm. and then being in my own therapy, which was required, and I also needed it, so I'm grateful. Mm-hmm. but then also, you know, starting to do therapy and learn how to do therapy, I started to see these relational processes that God created and how mm-hmm. and see them actually work in my own life, so my own therapy. And that's part of why, you know, Rosemead is really a, you know, it's an apprenticeship model. So we, you know, teach students to do therapy through, you know, partly they're being in their own therapy, but then also us supervising them, mm-hmm. you know, in the middle of the process. So it's not just read a book, you know, it's learning by doing, right? So that was for me as well. I was experiencing it myself, and then I was learning by doing therapy and being supervised by some really outstanding supervisors and seeing it work, you know, seeing people actually actually heal and grow, and myself experiencing that. And there was a little bit of a lag, but then it did, with God, it did catch up. And then that sort of, you know, led to gradually more of a sense of connection and intimacy with God. And then, so the contrast back to your question was seeing that, okay, I'm learning how all this is working and experiencing it in a very new way, and it's not being addressed at all in the church, in my experience anyway. Mm-hmm. It's not being talked about. These processes aren't being talked about. There's not really an understanding of these processes. And it's just not being touched.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. And you talk about this early on in the book. Again, one of the things that I thought was helpful was exploring the history of how we got here, and, you know, I don't know, 1300s, it wasn't necessarily always like this. That post-Enlightenment, we have this logic, reason, emphasis that hasn't always been around, or hasn't always been the case for the church. And so with the movement towards everything that came out of that, you see this overemphasis on the intellect and that explicit knowledge that you're talking about. It's been interesting to see how that has now, like you said, the last couple of decades has started to shift a little bit, but it almost seems like therapy, which I've experienced as an incredible tool in my own sanctification journey, is just this side thing that's reserved over here in the corner for maybe those that have a little bit bigger issues than the rest of us. And so one of the things that Thompson talks about that I think is cool is that he would argue in a lot of cases, that kind of work, that sanctification work, should be taking place in small faith community rather than in therapy, and that we've kind of partitioned it off and reserved it over there in the corner as its own thing. But it should be taking place in small faith community. How do we, and maybe this is a bigger question than we can even answer in this podcast, but how do we start moving in the direction to where it's not always reserved just for therapy, or not always reserved just for one-on-one mentorship, but that we start moving in this direction where it is it's something that is taking place, that we're exploring our stories in these safe environments where I can be honest with the struggles that I have. I can be vulnerable with what I'm going through, what I'm maybe wrestling over with God over, and have other people hear our stories in safe environments to process that with one another. And I mean, I think you see it in pockets within the church across the country, and maybe more so across the world, but there doesn't seem to be any real significant movement towards that, like a large scale movement. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Yeah. So many ideas there to unpack, but
we'll go whatever direction you want to go.
Yeah. So first of all, the partition piece and what you mentioned, Kurt Thompson said, I totally agree with that. I think that's part of what I'm up to with the Relational Spirituality Academy and all of my work, is this idea that I do think there's a place for therapy and it's important.
Right.
You know, it's sacred work.
Absolutely.
But I think part of what has happened as a result of the sort of specialization movement and fields becoming, you know, more and more narrow and specialized is that pastors don't as much get trained in these kinds of processes anymore. And that's starting to change a little bit. There is some meaningful movement in that direction. But, you know, 20, 30 years ago, that was not the case at all. So they're not getting trained in these kinds of processes. And so they start to feel that they're, you know, they're not qualified to deal with deeper issues, relational issues. And so that gets farmed out to psychology, you know, clinical psychology. Mm-hmm. And I think all of these, that's not to say pastors should be doing therapy, but it is to say that the relational process that, you know, sanctification is fundamentally relational. And so all these relational processes of understanding how our early childhood and family have impacted, you know, how we feel about ourselves, how we relate, how we experience God, our attachment, all those kinds of things are an integral part of the sanctification process. They cannot be separated. And so they need to be dealt with within the church. So one way I say this a lot is, you know, these are God's processes. God created us to function this way. So these, you know, this, another way to say it is this knowledge about how relationships form and shape us and how they change and grow and what healthy relationships look like, that knowledge does not belong to psychology per se, to be partitioned off so that the church doesn't have access to it and they just have to refer to, you know, it. No, it belongs to God. God created it and it should be used within the context of helping people grow in intimacy with God and grow in love of God and others, you know, within the church. So yeah, I very much agree with Kurt on that. And that's part of what I'm trying to do. And then, you know, your broader question, well, how do we move toward that is a big question. I think there is some movement, like I said. So, you know, when I was in grad school 30 years ago, there really was more of a split. There was more of a kind of a broader sort of anti-psychology kind of, you know, movement and feeling in the church. And then people weren't anti-psychology. I think there was much more just like, we're not really sure about that. You know, it's not part of what we should be thinking about or doing. I think in, you know, recent years, because of the rise of mental health issues and loneliness, you know, pandemic sort of exacerbated that, but it was even happening before the pandemic. I think we've been kind of forced to talk about mental health issues, right? And so there's more openness to the church, within the church, to talk about mental health issues and psychology. So that's been good. I think also part of it is younger generation of pastors coming online who are more exposed to this and more often have been in therapy and benefited from it, which, by the way, that's the, like, the number one thing that causes pastors, leads them to, you know, to refer and collaborate with mental health practitioners, is that they, you know, they've had a positive experience themselves and they know the mental health practitioner. So there's a trust level there and there's also an experience that they've had. So that's important. But so I've talked to a number of my grad students now and who have, you know, attending churches with, you know, younger pastors than me. And a lot of them say, like, yeah, you know, pastor talks about being in therapy and, you know, very openly from the pulpit and things like that. So I think that's good. We're also seeing more seminaries with spiritual formation programs and that, you know, broader kind of movement, which I think integrates a lot of these ideas about relational growth. But having said that, I think there's a lot of work to do, and there's still a lot of pastors that didn't get that training or they're just overwhelmed, that sort of thing. And so I think it has to start with the pastors and leaders in the church having this experience. So I think it's going to require, that's part of what I'm doing. I think it's part of what, you know, Kurt Thompson and, you know, others are doing, and some of these seminary programs, is helping leaders to enter into a process and a journey to look at their interior life and their relationships and their attachment and how their past has impacted them, right? So they can experience deeper intimacy. And then, because that has to happen to some extent before they can carry that forward and bring that to the people in their church, right? And so I think it's a tandem thing of having the experience and then helping them to understand conceptually, how does this all work, right? It has to be both because you can't just like read a book and like, okay, go teach this in church if you haven't had the experience. And most pastors wouldn't be open to doing that anyway, right?
Right.
So I think it's got to be an organic movement and process. Practicing the Way is another example of, you know, I've done some work with them. Very, very relational focus. I mean, they're focused on, you know, also, you know, spiritual formation as an apprenticeship to Jesus, right? Which is relational, right? It's like following Jesus in relationship with him, abiding in him. And some of that is developing practices and habits that help you become a certain kind of person where you can, you know, relate in a loving way to God and others. So they're doing a lot of great work as well. So I think it's just got to be an organic process of, you know, a number of leaders and organizations helping church leaders, ministry leaders to go on this journey so that they can lead others through it, you know, in their church. Because if they haven't had that experience, what I find is, I think part of why it doesn't happen is it's overwhelming and scary. If you, if you've never looked inside and you don't know what's in there, you know, it's this dark cave and it's scary and it's messy. Right. Whereas developing programs and getting people to show up and entertain them and teach them and give them more head knowledge, right? That's a little easier to measure and track. But when you start getting into like help facilitating a process where people's hearts change, that's pretty difficult and messy.
Yeah, difficult to quantify it. I think that's that. I agree. I think that that's part of the difficulty in seeing this maybe gain the traction that we'd like it to gain, and is that it relationship is a messy process. And so saying I'm going to saying we're going to shift in how we maybe do church, if I'm just going to say it in a broad term like that, and being willing to go this route, that's a messy, messy route and comes with all kinds of challenges that I wonder if the hesitancy is, well, it's just easier and that's the harder road. If the relationship is always the messier, more difficult road. Yeah. And so for a, especially for a church or maybe an established church to make that kind of shift, you're making a commitment to, it's cultural, right? There's some significant cultural elements, church cultural elements to this that seem to be maybe a barrier to entry.
Right, right. Yeah, again, if the leadership haven't had this experience, they might not value it or think it's worthwhile. And I think part of the underlying reason, again, is it's probably scary because it just feels, it's unknown, it's messy. And then you try to, you know, even if they enter into that journey, they start to then bring that to the congregation at some level and you're going to get resistance, right? You're just going to be people who also have not looked inside. And it's easy to come up with arguments for, you know, sort of rational conceptual arguments for why this is unimportant and not really part of sanctification or what we should be doing, you know? But a lot of that's motivated by fear and anxiety, you know, about like, well, if I really looked inside, I'm not sure what's there. And there's a lot of pain there that I don't want to look at. And so let's not do that. So there's gonna be a lot of resistance there to that. So I think it's got to be a slow process. And there has to be another very important point, Zach, is I think there has to be enough safety created first in order to help people go there, including leaders, right? I mean, leaders are people, right?
Right.
The same way. There has to be safety. You can't just go in and say, we're doing this and expect a commitment and for people to dive in when there's not relational safety. So it really has to be a gradual process of, you know, and I do think leaders have to model it, right? So they have to show the congregation, like, I'm on a journey, we're on a journey, this is what it looks like. And yes,
it's okay that it's messy.
Yeah, it's messy, but it's okay that it's messy. And here's the quote benefits of this journey, right? To that's maybe a crass term, but like, or fruit is a better term, maybe, right? That yes, it's messy, We don't have it all figured out. It's not a linear process, but there is fruit, and that is deeper intimacy with God, mm-hmm. deeper knowledge of self, deeper knowledge of God, a sense of closeness, deeper trust, right? Which is what faith is, that it's not all or nothing, but that grows as you understand more deeply your own story, like we were talking about earlier, how people, your important relationships have impacted you, your attachment styles, which we'll probably get into, how that shapes how you experience God. All those things lead to deeper intimacy with God and a deeper capacity to love God and love others, which is really what sanctification is all about.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting you bring up the that vulnerability piece, that going, pursuing this kind of sanctification journey or discipleship, whatever term we want to use, it requires a level of vulnerability, especially from leadership. And that's been our experience. That's been my experience working within the ministry space, coming from the marketing and communication side, where I've been working in this space for about 15 years, and the constant challenge with probably every single ministry I've ever worked with is in my attempts to get them to move towards more story first or story driven methods of communication. The barrier seems to, and I haven't come to this conclusion until maybe the last couple years, because I'm constantly trying to figure out, okay, what's the real problem behind why ministries won't tell their stories, or why they can't get in a consistent rhythm of communicating story and testifying rather of what God is doing through their organization or their ministry versus how awesome their organization is and how great their work is. Mm-hmm. And the conclusion that I've come to is that the storytelling process, whether I'm sitting in front of a camera and sharing my story via social media and digital, or I'm sitting in a small group with three other guys and processing my story within a small faith community situation, the thing that comes up constantly and consistently is there's a level of vulnerability that is required for me to actually share my story truthfully and honestly and faithfully. Mm-hmm. That is really uncomfortable. Like, that's a difficult thing to do, is to share my story, no matter what the context is, whether it's a stage and 1,000 people in front of you, or a mobile device and social media content, or like I said, in that kind of faith, small group, whatever situation. It requires a level of vulnerability to get over the maybe the pain or the insecurities or whatever it is that causes me to not share my story. Mm-hmm. That level of vulnerability seems to be the thing that keeps us from sharing our stories or processing our stories or being story driven in our communications. And the conclusion that I've come to at this point is I still don't know how to solve that problem, because it is the end point to every single conversation I've ever had in the things that we've tried or the conversations that we've had. And so back to your point, where there's a level of this that has to come from leadership, that we have to be, as leaders, be willing to be vulnerable in our own stories. Mm-hmm. If we're then going to ask our congregations, our organizations, our beneficiaries, whatever it is, whoever it is, mm-hmm. we're going to be asking them to be vulnerable and share their story. Like, we have to lead in that way. And yeah. that, man, to find leaders within the church who are willing to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. It comes back to that cultural piece. Like, a lot of times, us as leaders, the propensity or the desires to look like we have it all together, because we're the ones that are leading, and that we right. have, you know, if I'm going to lead, like, I have to have my stuff together before I can lead you. And,
right.
and that's to create those safe spaces. Like, there's all kinds of stuff that goes into this that is a challenge, but, mm-hmm. That vulnerability piece, I know that's a hot topic. It's something that's trendy. It's talked about a lot, but it seems to be the thing that I keep coming back to. Has that been your experience?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. I think you're spot on, Zach. And yeah, because I mean, there's a reason it's talked about because vulnerability is inherently difficult and scary. And as you were just saying, you know, at the leadership level, there's a lot of pressure to have it all together. If it's not stated explicitly, but there is kind of that pressure. And, you know, but oftentimes it goes back to our attachment story, right? So some experiences with important people, attachment figures, parents, other people who are caregivers for us, not showing up and being there when we needed them. And so vulnerability is scary because we expect, based on those experiences, I'm going to be hurt. I'm going to be disappointed. I'm going to be left out there hanging if I'm vulnerable, right? And so leaders need to model it for the church, but leaders, as you're just saying, you know, it's also hard for leaders. And so we need to help leaders have new experiences as well as people in the church, right? Where this is what rewires it. When you're able to be vulnerable. And so that always requires risk, right? It involves risk. You have to take a risk to step out and be a little bit more vulnerable than is comfortable, and risk being hurt or disappointed, right? But when you have a new experience of people being responsive, feeling accepted and known, all those kind of good things that go along with secure attachment, that begins to rewire and make it a little bit more safe to do that, and then helps leaders to be able to model that, you know, for people in the church.
Well, that's part of the way I came to know about you and your work specifically with the Academy is, again, the conclusions that I had come to on the Marcom side. It's like, if I can't get leaders to take seriously the significance and the power of story within marketing communications, because of this vulnerability thing, going upstream of what we were doing, what I've spent most of my career doing, working within the agency space, the creative agency, digital marketing agency space, we got to go higher upstream if we're going to solve these lower downstream issues. And getting leaders willing to lead with story in everything that they do, not just Marcom, that requires, that's how I found out about the Academy, was that it requires us to come alongside leaders and help in that process of discovering the power of story and vulnerability. And then if we can get them experiencing that, like I've experienced it, like you've experienced it, then maybe it can have this trickle down effect within the rest of the organization, within the rest of the leadership team, to where now the entire team understands and recognizes, okay, there is value in this storytelling thing, whatever the application is. And now, because we've experienced it, again, back to the implicit knowledge idea, we've experienced it at a heart level, not just an intellect, explicit knowledge level. Now we can start having these conversations of what it looks like to rewire, restructure our marketing communications and lead with story in those areas, because we've experienced it at higher levels upstream. So I when I learned about your Academy, I was like, oh, this is exactly what I've been looking for and super interested. I still have not gone through the process yet, but what are you doing within that Academy around what I just said, this idea of coming alongside leaders and helping them experience the power of that safety and vulnerability stuff?
Yeah.
And what are the results that you guys are seeing as leaders walk through that journey?
Yeah. So there's a couple things. So we structure it so that there is a teaching component about, and so it's framed around kind of a coaching model, because that's a pretty broad model that can be easily imported into discipleship, leading teams. So we have people who kind of across a range of professional contexts. But coaching felt like a good kind of modality to kind of anchor it in. And so there's some, you know, teaching around that, but from a relational spirituality perspective, understanding all this stuff that we're talking about. But then we meet, you know, over Zoom, and the second hour is, you know, we meet for a couple hours. we process the material the first hour, so it's not just, I'm not just regurgitating content from the videos, you know, really talking through how does this apply to your own life and ministry context. And there's homework and, you know, exercises to reflect on this stuff in their own personal life. And so for example, in the first module, we start off with, you know, they go through this attachment filter matrix kind of exercise where they map their, like their top five most important relationships, including God, where do they fall in these attachment filter, you know, sort of quadrants, and then reflect and then write out their attachment story, people who have shaped them, how that's showing up in their current relationships, how that shows up in their relationship with God. And oftentimes many of these ministry leaders have never done that. And so some of the, you know, the sort of results you're asking about are, you know, the experiential learning, I guess would be a way to say it, right? It's not just all at once, right? It happens gradually over the course of the coaching program, but oftentimes in the beginning, it's just connecting the dots that they've never really done before about, like, oh my gosh, I've got some, there's some really significant components of anxiety and anxious attachment with my mom or dad or, you know, whoever it is. And I can see that same pattern with God. And I've never really realized that before. Right. So there's a lot of aha moments around that. And so we start off, you know, right in the beginning, module one. And one of my big emphases all throughout is what we've been talking about here, which is, you know, one way to say it is the idea that, you know, you are the tool. your own health is fundamental to being able to help other people grow spiritually and emotionally and relationally, right, in a holistic way. And so you've got to be on your own journey and in your own process of growing in these things, growing in secure attachment. So we start right away with that. And so there's exercises throughout, and it just goes deeper. You know, it starts off with some, you know, high level overview of attachment with some of those exercises. Then we go deeper into some of the more nuanced aspects of attachment and the more exercises and reflection questions throughout. And then, for example, we get into what I call core protection patterns. And there's some common ones for each of the insecure attachment styles. And so we have them reflect on that for themselves, as well as all throughout in parallel. How do you help facilitate a process of healing and growth for the people you're working with in coaching or discipleship, you know, whatever the context is, to understand, you know, core protection patterns would be, for example, somebody with anxious attachment, when they get activated and especially experience distress or loss or something like that, they tend to hyperactivate their attachment system, become clingy and demanding because they're afraid of abandonment.
Right.
Understandably, right? So their strategy they learned early on is, man, I have to figure out where my attachment figures are and if they're going to be available. And I'm afraid they're not. So I need to, like, grab onto them, you know, literally when they're a child and then figuratively as an adult emotionally. Right. Okay. So then you think about if you're doing that consistently with people in your life, oftentimes, you know, people, when they experience that, they withdraw. Right. If you're grabbing onto me and clinging and demanding and requiring me to kind of regulate your emotions, that's a little overwhelming, right? So I might back up and withdraw. And so what does that do? Reinforces the pattern and the message that people are overwhelmed by me, right? So this is the, kind of the implicit, you know, internal working model or message about the self. And so... so we talk about that in terms of their own life. How does that show up? But also, you know, with people they're working with. And then in the second hour, we have them get into small groups with facilitators who've been through the program and practice coaching conversations. And that has proven to be very powerful. I mean, I've honestly been pleasantly surprised in a way that there's just, you know, I think it's partly because there's a self-selection process of people who join the program who, you know, they value this perspective, right? Doesn't mean they have it all figured out. They may not be super far along in the journey, but they're enough that they're like, okay, I get that I need to do some internal work and that my relationships shape me. And this is really what it's all about. And I want to, you know, jump into this. So there tends to be, people tend to be able to go deep pretty quickly in these, you know, small groups and share you know, real things that are going on. You know, not necessarily things where they're completely falling apart, but, you know, meaningful things they're sharing. And so they're reporting back like very meaningful coaching conversations. And I think the key there is that they're getting practice actually coaching. So it's not just reading about it. They're actually doing it, and they're getting feedback from a facilitator, you know, who's been through, plus peer feedback. And then they also go through with a volunteer client and do at least 6 sessions with, you know, of coaching from this perspective with some kind of, you know, a framework that I've provided them to kind of help guide the process. So again, they're getting more practice actually doing it and getting feedback. But so, yeah, those are, I think we see kind of progressively deeper, you know, realizations about their own attachment in particular, and how that plays out in their relationship with God and with other people. And I think it also leads, you know, when that happens and you start to see these issues in your own life more, that naturally generates more compassion for others, right? Because you realize this is not something that in most cases people are not consciously, you know, choosing to be unhealthy and cause problems in relationships, right?
Right.
It's these unconscious patterns of the implicit self, I call it, that play out. So when people realize that and see that in themselves more deeply, it generates compassion for others and helps them be more compassionate.
Yeah. So, I mean, how many years have you been doing this academy now?
So we're in this 6th cohort right now. So it's been a little over 3 years.
Okay.
But so yeah, new cohorts once a semester, twice a year.
Gotcha. And so maybe specifically for the pastors who have gone through the academy, are you seeing them then take this and apply it within their local church context and local congregations? And obviously as leaders, be more compassionate and recognize maybe some of the patterns within the people of their congregation, but like really starting to apply some of the things that they've learned within a local congregation, local church context, and what comes out of that, you know, that small of faith community application.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. We have definitely, you know, quite a few pastors, you know, associate pastors, some small group pastors, some spiritual formation pastors, one guy who was a worship pastor and then pivoted to spiritual formation pastor. And so, yeah, I think they are bringing it back to their church, to small groups, to, you know, a lot of their ministry context, and using some of the tools as well, you know, like the coaching kind of protocol sort of that I developed that I just mentioned. And that starts with, and so initially I developed what I call a deep growth narrative interview. And that was designed to just be you know, kind of a tool to help people get a little practice doing a, you know, kind of a coaching session, just calling it an interview. And then that became kind of the first session of this protocol. And so we're getting reports back from people that's, you know, incredibly helpful. And it incorporates attachment theory and some things from the adult attachment interview, but also story, you know, principles that we've been talking about. And so, and also some work from positive psychology. So kind of starting off with like a positive vision of the self. And, you know, if you think about, you know, like, you know, a few years down the road, what would be a vision of yourself, you know, more sanctified Zach that you would like to see? What would that look like? You know, and there's a lot of research on that's really helpful to activate positive emotion and kind of create, you know, resources and that sort of thing. But, and then we go through, you know, some questions around attachment. And so it's really just helping people to kind of be present to the story, helping them tell their attachment story, essentially, you know, what did this look like? How's this played out with, you know, caregivers early on? How does this impact your relationship with God? And then kind of moving into like, where, you know, how do you want to grow and what are some things you can do? And so that honestly has been way more impactful than I thought. It's one of those things where I kind of came up with it initially on the fly just to sort of like, okay, we need a tool to help people who don't have much experience, just give them some guardrails, you know? And then people are coming back going like, wow. And I've revised it a couple of times. It just has gotten more, you know, it's gotten better over time, but that's been, you know, really pleasant surprise. I've seen God work through that. And that's something that an example of something pastors are taking back to their churches and using that with small groups, and, you know, as well as some of the other tools, you know, and some of it's just, and some of the assessments, you know, there's this attachment filter matrix assessment. So they're using that. There's some more, you know, broader assessments that are more, you know, full blown assessments that they're using as well.
Well, it sounds like there's some, this is maybe going back to some of the problem stuff that you were running into or recognized early on, that we discussed already, but how, I want to think about how I frame this question. How much have you seen maybe this, I don't know if I would call it a trend or a trend within the church of a fuller understanding of the redemptive relationships that God is after, that he's not just after a redemptive relationship with between us and him and us and others, but he is after a redemptive relationship. There's four redemptive relationships he's after: us and him, us and others, us and ourselves, and us in creation. And creation, there's a lot that falls under that. How the kingdom is coming into being ushered into my business, how I'm stewarding my finances, creation, care, and stewardship, all of that stuff falls in that care category. But specifically those last two, my redemptive relationship with between me and creation and my redemptive relationship between me and myself, that historically it seems like there's been this, I've experienced it within my own faith background, that that's not something we're supposed to explore because I'm a new creation. And so I don't need to worry about being introspective and understanding the deeper whys of how and why I relate to God the way that I do because of my story and because of my early relationships. We're not going to go into that because it's just something that we should avoid. Kind of has been the church's or much of the church's default position around this. And so as you guys talk about that, is that even still today, as there seems to be a movement towards that fuller understanding of those four redemptive relationships he's after, less opposition to that idea, maybe?
I think so in general. I think that would go along with kind of the spiritual formation movement that I mentioned that's kind of grown over the past, you know, 34 years. This would be like, you know, Richard Foster and Dallas Willard and that whole group and that, you know, growing. So this would go back to the probably 1970s. And so, as I mentioned, like we're seeing more seminary programs with spiritual formation, you know, programs. You know, at the same time, there's still pockets of, you know, definitely in the church of a certain, probably more denominations or traditions maybe that are either opposed to psychology or at least maybe a little wary or just
hesitant.
Hesitant, not really involved with psychology. There's still some of that. And I think some of the more, I think because of the polarization of our society, we're getting, you know, like some of those smaller pockets have like dug their heels in more of like, you know, hey, psychology is really not what we should be. It's not of God, basically, right? And so I think that
it just gets lumped into some other categories that might have some baggage or chains connected to them.
Exactly. And I think that ties into what you're saying about the value of introspection and looking at the self, right? And so there's sometimes this view that goes back quite a ways of like, yeah, we shouldn't do that. And that's just navel gazing. And, you know, what's the point of that? It's self-centered. Why are you, you know, why would you spend time focusing on yourself? It's self-focused, that type of thing. And, you know, my response to that is it depends on how you're approaching it. Sure, there's a way to, you know, kind of introspect that is narcissistic and navel gazing, and that's not sanctification, right? But there is a way to approach that where the purpose of it is twofold. You know, one is that to know ourselves, not just to focus on ourselves, right? But to develop the capacity to love God and love others better. And that is sanctification, right? And it's necessary. So I think that's kind of the message within spiritual formation and, you know, relational spirituality is And this is, you know, I mean, this goes back to Calvin, the double knowledge, you know, knowledge of self and knowledge of God. So it's not like this hasn't been there. But mm-hmm. you cannot know God, know others, love God, if you don't know yourself and you don't know what's going on inside of you and you're not able to regulate your emotions, right? All of that. So it's an integral part of the process of growing in your capacity to love, to have, be on this interior journey, to be aware of yourself and, regulate your emotions, understand how things impact you and be able to manage that, you know, all those kinds of things. So I think that's, I think with spiritual formation and relational spirituality, that's growing. There's more acceptance of that. But I do think it's got to be framed in a certain way that it's not just for navel gazing. It's to help us grow.
Right.
Love.
Well, and to be able to recognize, I think there's power in the ability to recognize both things that have hurt me and I might need to lay at the foot of the cross for healing, but also things that I might have caused that need to be repented of that I'm, you know, not aware of. So the idea that we don't self introspect and don't aren't self aware just because now we're a new creation. I don't know how those things work together. If you're not able to recognize the ways in which if I'm not self-aware enough to recognize the ways in which I'm rebelling against the creator of heavens and earth, then like what am I actually repenting of then? Right.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, being a new creation, like, you know, in one sense is fully accomplished by the work of Christ, but in another sense is a process, right?
Right.
And that
right.
seems pretty clear in the New Testament, right? That Paul uses process language a lot. We're saved and justified at one point in time, but we're, you know, clothed in righteousness and we're involved in this process. The new creation part, there's still ongoing work to do. And a big part of that is self-awareness because, yeah, if you're not aware of how you have experienced hurt from someone or something like that, it's going to come out in other ways that it's not going to be loving.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to cause you to, you know, be dysregulated and contribute to insecure attachment and all of that, and ultimately not be loving. So it's, again, it's part of the process of growing in your capacity to love.
Mm. Can you dig into the storytelling side a little bit more? If we've maybe missed something on that narrative side that you maybe want to touch on. I mean, that's the thing that I'm most passionate about. So I'm always interested in learning what the importance and value of story has and its implication for ministry and its implications for leadership and spiritual formation. I'm fascinated by that idea. And so obviously there's a lot to it. There's a history to this. There's cultural elements to this. One of the things that I talk about a lot is we, in the West, are most of the world functions in orality communication culture, stories first or story centric communication culture. In the West, we're more of a literacy based communication culture. And what you're seeing, I think, and this is argued by a secular author in a book called Story Wars. He's talking about the move from the broadcast era to he calls it a pseudo oral tradition communication culture because of digital and social media specifically, in that within that broadcast era, radio and TV, where we had no control over the narratives that were presented to us, now we've moved back to this oral tradition culture where the ideas or the stories that are fed to us, we can either choose to say, yeah, that's a story that, or a narrative that I agree to, and I can share that and push that forward, or I can ignore it and move on. Mm-hmm. And so we're functioning in, and generations, my generation and younger, are now growing up in a world where they do have some say in the stories that they're continuing to push and promote. Mm-hmm. And we're moving back into this oral tradition culture. And so that shift back towards orality, which is where most of the world has functioned, and still 70% of the world still functions in that kind of communication culture. What are the implications for that as we move to that kind of, as that shift takes place? I think especially with younger generations, you're starting to see much more willingness and openness to this psychology and stuff, the therapy that we've talked about. And so it's fascinating to see the shift taking place and recognize it. And then for me, say, okay, how do we now take this and start applying it within a church context and within a digital context and within a leadership development context? Because there now is seeming to be more of an openness to it. So I just wondered if you had any other thoughts on story and narrative and the implications of it within the context of this conversation.
Yeah. So a number of points. So, I mean, first I would say story is implicit relational knowledge. That is why it's so powerful. So when you stop and think about, why do a group of people go to a dark movie theater and sit with a bunch of strangers? You know, hopefully a couple people you know, but a bunch of strangers, and watch these stories, right? When you take a step back and think about it, it's kind of odd behavior, right? But it's because the story captures us and it communicates a message implicitly through the structure of the story, right? So it's not through, well, and this is kind of, you know, we sometimes joke about bad writing, right? So what is bad writing in a, you know, in a movie or, you know, TV show context, right? Is when it's like too on the head, right? And it's when a character tells you the message, right?
Right.
Of the story. Right. And you're like, oh, okay, that just feels a little over the top, a little too on the nose, right? But the powerful, the stories, the movies, to use that genre as an example, right, that really impact us. So the way I describe it in Connected Life is that, and I think relational spirituality is, you know, we have to feel ideas. That's part of the knowledge bio, right? So stories help us to feel ideas, right? So you walk away from a great movie feeling an idea. And you may be able to translate it into words, right? But good movies don't just come around and say like, hey, okay, let me just tell you, you know, as the writer, this is the message I'm really trying to convey to you guys in case you didn't get it through the story, right? No, it comes through the structure, and primarily it comes through the conflict, right?
Yeah.
So there's that conflict where the protagonist wants something, there are forces of antagonism working against it, and then usually there's a dilemma, right, where it's like, there's two bad choices, or, you know, and the character of the protagonist is tested. And so it's choice the protagonist makes in the midst of this dilemma and conflict that reveals the character and conveys a message. Like one example I give is one of the Star Wars movies, the episode where, you know, Luke is fighting Darth Vader. Right. And if, I think this is the second one in the first set of three, but where the Emperor is in the background goading him on, if you remember that scene, so he's goading Luke to like give into the dark side of the Force. Right. And let it take him over and then defeat Vader. Sure. Right. Cause then you're going to join me on the dark side. Right. And so for a moment they're doing this lightsaber battle, and there's a moment where Luke just goes nuts. Right. And cuts off Vader's arm. You remember that?
Yep.
And Vader's like down on a knee. Luke has him. Like he gave into his anger, which is what, for a moment, right, what the Emperor was like goading him to. Right. So then what did he do after that? Like he has a moment of decision. He could either like continue to go nuts, give into the dark side of the Force and maybe kill Vader, or he can stop, not fight him, and try to, you know, he sees the good in Vader, right? And to try to go with that. Mm-hmm. And so the message is not, you know, the movie doesn't just tell you like, well, you know, this is kind of the message we want to convey. You feel the idea through Luke's actions, in that moment. Right. Like he closes the lightsaber and throws it down and decides, I'm not going to do that. Right. And so what's the message? Well, something like, you know, if we don't give in to the dark side, you know, and go with the good side or the light side of the force, love will win.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something like that. And again, it's the point is not to be able to put it perfectly into words, but there's some kind of message there or idea mm-hmm. that we feel. So my point in all that, Zach, is just like, that's why it's so powerful. And especially back to just the context of like information overload in our world and AI, right? It's like people are even more gravitating towards stories. So another way to say it is like stories is how we connect. We're just wired to connect through stories, right? When we hear, I mean, we tell stories all day long, right? When you get together with friends, you don't get together and just recount and just exchange information usually, right?
Right.
Or recount events that have happened. No, mm-hmm. you tell your story, even if it's just like this thing that happened at work today or this weird conversation I had, right? That's a story, right? Because it's your interpretation of events, which is always subjective.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another reason why stories are so powerful, because it's your subjective interpretation of, you know, the events that have happened to you. And that's the way memory works, right? Is it's not like an objective thing you take off the shelf when you're, you know, telling the story. It's always filtered through your personal lens and how you interpret it and your mood and all of that. So it's powerful. It's communicated through the you know, structure, and I think that it's just something that people are going to gravitate even more toward. And then so the other kind of point I was going to make that's a little bit different direction, but you know, we've learned a lot from neuroscience, and the adult attachment interview is a really fascinating example where they code. So people tell their attachment story in the adult attachment interview, and the developer of that, Mary Main, developed a coding system that's based on narrative coherence.
Okay.
So the two insecure types of attachment, the main ones, dismissing is what it's called in adults, or avoidant, and then preoccupied or anxious. There's also disorganized, but those are the two main ones. They're incoherent in systematically different ways. So they're both systematic. They're both incoherent because they're not telling their story in a coherent way. For the avoidant or dismissing people, it tends to be logic and facts with no emotional meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So you've probably met people like that, right? Where they tell a quote story, but it's just like a bunch of events that happen, and there's no emotion words. There's no conveying of emotion that indicates what the experience has meant to the person.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very stale and you don't feel connected, right? When that happens. So that's an example of, you know, why being able to tell our story in a coherent way is really important, and it's correlated with secure attachment. On the other side, with anxious or preoccupied attachment, people, and when they're in that state of mind, so to speak, they tend to tell stories where they get sort of caught up in emotional pain that comes up. And so there's a lot of emotion, but very little structure or sequence. And so people get lost and feel, you know, kind of overwhelmed. So that's also incoherent. And so growing in secure attachment is very much the same thing as growing in our ability to tell our story coherently. So one of the really fascinating things about the adult attachment interview as well is that people can be categorized as securely attached even if they had a really rough childhood, even if there was, you know, neglect, abuse, trauma, because it's not coding based on what kind of childhood you had. It's coding based on how you tell your story about the childhood you did have, and to what degree is it coherent. And more coherence, another way to say that is it reflects more integration internally, that you've processed what's happened to you and the meaning of it. And so you're able to convey it to other people in a coherent way, meaning it's logical and it's structured, but you're also able to convey the meaning of it to you.
Mm. And when we can process that meaning, then we can process the hurt or the ideas that we feel. Like one of the things that you, I was flipping through your book, The Connected Life, before this call. I haven't started reading it, but one of the things that I noticed flipping through was you quote Robert McKee, who I quote all the time. I have a whole course on why story, where we talk about specifically his definition of his definition for story, in that he says, the definition of story is conflict changes life, right? So when I saw that you had quoted McKee, I was like, we're like minds here. But
kindred spirits,
that idea, kindred spirits. This, the idea that you just said is fascinating to me, that story is how we feel ideas.
Yeah.
And that there are ideas, specifically with my relationship with the Lord, there are ideas that I have about God and how he views me, how he, whether or not he loves me, or whether or not he is proud of me, or whether or not he delights in me, that I can change those ideas about how he feels about me, whether scripture tells me it or not, right? I can know those things in my head theologically and doctrinally and believe them intellectually, that he delights in me, that he loves me, that he's proud of me, that regardless of whether or not I am obedient, that those things still are true, right? Mm-hmm. That I can believe intellectually, but knowing that in my heart, that's the difficult part. And what you're saying is that I can change those ideas about how God views me through that storytelling process. The process of storytelling, telling a better story, helps me change the ideas or shift the ideas in how I view God, the way that I view him. Mm-hmm. And that process takes place in relationship with others. That if as I tell a better story in relationship with others, that those ideas that I have about God, or those ideas that I have about my relationship with others, can start to change.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. The more secure you become internally, the more able you are to tell a coherent story. And practicing, you know, telling your story is like working a muscle, right? So it's like the more you do that, mm-hmm. and you're able to take little steps of growth and telling it a little bit more coherently, that's helping you become more secure. Because what that's doing is it's helping you to regulate your emotions more as you're telling, especially a difficult, painful story, and to like keep track of the sequence, mm-hmm. and also keep the emotional meaning online without becoming overwhelmed yourself and overwhelming others. That's an example of what is going on sort of under the hood when it's becoming more coherent. And it's also, so it's you telling your own story more coherently and also hearing others' stories, because then you're feeling these ideas. That's why, you know, testimonials in church are so powerful. Why we use stories in sermons, right? It's because these modalities, story helps us to feel these ideas and experience them. And that's what happens with movies and TV shows and
right. novels. Well, it's Revelation 19:10 that says that the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy, that when I am testifying of what he's done in my life, the transformation that has taken place in my life through his redemptive work, that when somebody is receiving and hearing that story, it is a prophetic statement that says what has happened in my life can happen in your life too. Mm-hmm. Right. So that idea that you just shared of somebody receiving my story, that is also, it's a healing process for both of us. It's a prophetic right. statement for both of us.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm, that's good.
Yeah.
And the structure piece is really interesting to me because we've talked a lot about it. I teach it in our courses because we're trying to figure out the reason I've been so interested in story structure, and specifically we use and would teach the hero's journey, because I think it is the primary structure that you see throughout scripture over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. I think I would argue that it is hardwired into us by our creator, that it is the way in which he wires us and then communicates to us in the way that he's wired us to engage with story. And the idea of structure, there's a show creator of one of my favorite shows called Community. And in that show, the creator of that show is a guy named Dan Harmon. And he says that, I'm going to botch the quote, but he says essentially, without structure, story is no longer story. And what you're arguing is that in the process of sharing my story and receiving, hearing others receive my story and then receiving others' story, like that communal relational aspect of storytelling, I develop in my storytelling ability and the story structure capabilities that I have. And that also then has implications for my transformation and my health, spiritual health or mental health. Am I hearing that right?
Yeah, definitely. Right. They're correlated.
That's fascinating.
One is the manifestation of the other. So the more secure attachment, the more integrated you are internally, the more you can tell a coherent story. And then, practicing and doing that more and more coherently is part of the process of helping you become more securely attached. And hearing stories again, it helps you to feel ideas, which is what helps you to inhabit them and shift your implicit self. Right. Because that doesn't happen just through information.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And I agree. I mean, I think story structure is built in, and it's like, the gospel is the greatest story that's ever been told.
Right.
It's like when you look at the structure and how amazing in terms of the hero's journey and the main elements that McKee talks about and others. Mm-hmm. And also, I was just amazed when I read his book, how much psychology is just woven all throughout. His book and story structure in general, conflict reveals character, right? Like you truly see someone's character when you see how they respond to conflict. And I remember one of the things McKee, if you remember, talks about is seeing, sometimes these scripts you would get of people who did not follow story structure. And, they're trying to do some avant-garde thing. And he says, this is somebody having a temper tantrum on screen.
There's something
built in.
Without structure. I mean, we know it immediately, like you said earlier, we know it immediately when we see a bad story or a poorly constructed story.
Yeah.
It's like whether, we oftentimes will blame it on dialogue or blame it on good acting or whatever we're blaming on. Ultimately, at the end of the day, this story was not well written. It wasn't structured. It was not an actual story, right? There was no, there was no balance of conflict and hope, which without conflict, there is no hope. Mm-hmm. Right? You have to have these elements to a story in order for it to actually be a story. Mm-hmm. And so within the context of what I've been doing in the marketing space is, you've seen, pendulum swings within nonprofit communication for the last handful of decades, where for a long time it was just this guilt marketing, what I would call poverty porn, where you so heavily lean on the conflict and that's all you ever share, and there's no hope in that story, that it's not a story. And then the pendulum swung completely the other direction. And a lot of times now it's getting a lot better, but within, the last decade, there's been this only hope side of the story. And we're not actually telling the conflict that really does actually exist. I mean, the things that ministries are stepping into have real pain and real hurt and real trauma and real conflict. And if we don't communicate that side of the story, then the hope has no meaning. Right. And so, this is fascinating to hear. I've had a lot of assumptions about structure and would argue its importance, but to hear you say that I knew story had a physical healing element to it. In the process of sharing my stories and hearing others hear their stories or hear my story, that's like biologically a healing process, physically healing. But the structure piece, even within that being something that has healing potential, is really fascinating to me.
It's the actions that the protagonist take that, yeah, again, communicates the message implicitly. And mm-hmm. that's the feeling, the idea part. That's what makes it sink in and
right.
really impact us and shift our attachment model, working models and implicit self.
Mm. I have a buddy who runs a ministry called Soil and Roots. And basically it's a discipleship model and really a small group or home church model where they are, yes, going through some of that explicit knowledge work and you know, theological doctrinal work in the studying of scripture, but maybe more so they're going through the process as within small faith community of processing story mm-hmm. and the impact of my upbringing and how it affects how I relate to God the way that I do. And the transformation that's taking place within their community is really profound and significant mm-hmm. because yeah. they're experiencing, and he talks a lot about the ideas we have about God. Like when he read your book, it was like eye-opening because you were saying the exact same things he had been talking about for a long time. He has a book called Soil and Roots. And to hear you guys both saying essentially the same thing and then see that put into practice within his small faith communities, it's been really, really interesting to see yeah. that process and journey. So definitely. What you guys are arguing is actually taking place within these local communities or the small faith communities and mm-hmm. and real transformation is taking place. Like depth in their relationships with Jesus is happening and yeah. their capability and capacity to then love and have compassion for one another and others is significant. Yeah. And so yeah. mm-hmm. it's cool to see some of all the stuff that we're talking about again, intellectually, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of research to show that this is real, but then yeah. to actually see it experienced in real life
right.
has been cool.
Yeah. 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 I mean, story is the way that we, I think it's the way you know someone's personhood, you know, it's the way you, so I keep using this term implicit self, right? It's like,
mm-hmm.
I mean, we could probably use the term soul, right? I mean, there's a deeper aspect to yourself there. Sometimes I call it the relational operating system, right?
Mm-hmm.
This whole set of, you know, internal working models and operating system that drives how you relate, that's subconscious, right? And it's exists at the soul level. It's not your physical body. And I think when people tell their stories, it's like, that's how we, you know, we feel ideas. And I think we feel the personhood of the other person. And that's how we mm-hmm. truly know them. And that's what allows us to feel truly known and seen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Man, that's fascinating. I learned all kinds of things today. The structure thing is until you hear it, it's really doesn't sink in.
Putting the language what you knew implicitly, right? It's like you felt it, you knew it at some level, but then language helps to solidify it, which is super important. Yeah. I was reminded too, as you're talking, you'll see in The Connected Life, one of the things I talk about from McKee is he uses this phrase called aesthetic emotion.
Okay.
And that's what I'm talking about with feeling an idea. So it is feeling, but it's also an idea. It's just not like a proposition, you know, written
right
words. And so it's probably as close as we get to the integration of these two ways of knowing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and if these things are all true, and I think that they are, it starts to make scripture makes so much more sense. Like the reason why it is so heavily narrative and so story driven and story structured. I mean, 70% of the Bible is narrative in form, right? And so it starts to make sense that God, in that being the primary revelation of God to humanity in his pursuit of us and his love for us and his this redemptive narrative that we're all living inside of, that he chooses story and narrative as the primary method of communicating with humanity in who he one, created us in his image, but created us to engage and communicate within the structures that he's communicating mm-hmm. in that primary revelation. So for me, it's been really eye-opening to see like, okay, scripture makes so much more sense when you start to understand that than just, you know, a list of things or a list of doctrines that I need to subscribe to in order to, you know, be a part of the group.
Right, right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Cause he wants a relationship with us. So that involves
story,
telling our story and us understanding God's grand story, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not just a set of rules. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Todd, this has been a fascinating conversation, as I expected it would be. If people want to get a hold of you, learn more about what you're doing, maybe within the academy, get a hold of one of your books or both, how can they do so?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So the relationalspirituality.co is the main website to check out the academy, coaching program. There's also Relational Spirituality Lab, which is an ongoing membership where we provide tools and done-for-you resources for ministry leaders and coaches, so that you can get information about that. And all my books are on that site as well. And then we talked a little bit about assessments. So I've got a number of assessment tools that I've developed that I offer to organizations and, you know, churches and coaches and things like that. So that those tools are at spiritualmetrics.co.
Awesome.
So either one of those websites. Yeah.
Well, good.
And by the way, I should say that there's some free resources on at particularly relationalspirituality.co. So they can sign up to get, you know, attachment filter matrix, PDF to kind of work through some of the things we were talking about. There's a talk that I've done, a video of that talk that's an overview of relational spirituality that's free on the site.
Okay.
A little quiz to kind of look at, you know, your kind of readiness to be a relational spirituality coach and what would help you take next steps. That's all free on the website.
Mm, that's good. Well, appreciate that and appreciate you having you on the show. Can I pray for you as we wrap up?
Yes. Love that. Thank you.
Father, I just thank you so much for this conversation and the blessing I know it was for me. I pray that it would be a blessing to other ministry leaders who hear this. I pray that you would continue to lead and guide Todd and his team and all that you're doing through his ministry. I pray that it would continue to be a blessing to others, to those that he's mentoring and coaching and discipling. I know that it has been a blessing to me. And so I thank you for this opportunity to just hear his insights and expertise and, get a glimpse into his, the gifts and talents and skills and knowledge you've given him. Father, I pray that, you would continue to lead and guide him as he follows you and walks in alignment with you. I pray that, that this conversation would be a blessing to others and that it might help other leaders recognize the significance and power and importance of story and what it looks like to apply that to leadership, Lord, within your bride and within your church. We love you. We thank you that we get to be partnered with you in this redemptive story, that you could have done this on your own and you invited us into that. So we love you, and in Jesus' name we pray, amen.
Thank you.
Todd, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me, Zach. Enjoyed the conversation, and blessings in all your work and ministry.
Thank you. Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Ministry Growth Show. That was a conversation with Todd Hall. If you stayed with us through the whole thing, thanks for hanging in there. There's a lot in there worth sitting with. Here's what I want you to walk away with. The distance you feel from God or the distance you see in the people you lead is rarely a faith failure. It's almost always a formation gap. And the way that gap closes is slower, more relational, and more honest than most of our ministry rhythms are currently set up to support. That's not a critique of the church. It's an invitation. Something is shifting, and Todd Hall's work is part of helping the church recover what it had lost. If you want to go deeper with him, his books, Relational Spirituality and The Connected Life, are both worth your time. I'm in the middle of the first one right now. You can find his Relational Spirituality Academy and his other resources at relationalspirituality.co. A couple of asks before you go. If this episode was meaningful to you, The most helpful thing you can do is share it with one ministry leader who you think needs it. So much of what Todd named here is carried in silence. Sometimes the kindest thing you can do is hand someone a conversation they didn't have words for yet. And if you haven't already, follow the show wherever you listen so future episodes find you. The other thing, if what Todd talked about resonated and you sense the formation gap he described showing up in your own leadership, this is exactly what we built StoryQuest to address. StoryQuest is a leadership formation engagement for pastors, ministry leaders, and marketplace leaders who want to learn to tell the truth about their own story so they can shepherd their people toward telling theirs. It is unhurried, theologically grounded, and built for leaders who are ready to grow differently. You can learn more at storyquest.consulting. Until next time, may the people you lead find in you a leader who has learned to receive God's love before trying to give it away. I'm Zach Layton. Thanks for listening.